as we approach our time for the canvas to support this wonderful congregation. We would like to hear from some folks, and David is one today who will share his testimonial.
As our guest speaker and extraordinary musician in the pulpit last week stated, our seven principles are powerful. He went on to say the world needs these. I thought about what he said. I love our seven principles, how positive and affirming they are. Principle one, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, or put more simply, each person is important. I thought about how salient this principle was this week when I heard audio from the attorneys during the Chris Kyle, a.k.a. American Sniper, murder trial. How important is it that we as society today hold all human life to be precious? Those individuals with mental illness, those who feel called to serve our country, and those who do not. Principle two, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. Or to put more simply, be kind in all you do. Compassion. How important and perhaps underemphasized that trait is. This past week, I went to a coffee shop in the San Lorenzo area in the very early morning hours. As I entered in, I passed by a large shopping cart filled with blankets and other items. And upon entering the store, I saw a man who may have been homeless sleeping on the table right inside the front entrance door. Sadly, to be honest with you, one of my first thoughts that came to myself was, wow, I'm surprised no one has asked this man to move outside of the store. The coffee shop employees, I assume, chose to let him be. He lay there with his chapped, windblown knuckles, his bald head scorched from the sun, and the expression on his face with his eyes closed was one of complete exhaustion. Compassion. When we see another in need, do we try to ignore it or rationalize it? Or do we see and allow ourselves to recognize and feel empathy for that person? Principle three, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. Or put more simply, we are free to learn together. I love the way that we are called to learn from one another, young from old, old from young, and everything in between. I learn so much from young people, including my children. At the age of five, my youngest daughter seems to be in a constant present. The underdeveloped brain of a young child allows them to live in the now in a zen-like, playful state. I try to see the world through her eyes, without planning too much or overthinking, traps that I often fall prey to. On Thursday evening, Maya asked me, "Do we die in the air or in the ground?" These unique types of questions allow me to reflect and ponder what is being asked, and then think about how to share with my child about these rather heavy topics. I told her that we die on Earth, and then we decide where we want to go. In my mind, I guess, making a connection between the choice to be cremated or buried. Her response was, "I want to die in the air so that I can meet new people." Followed then by her saying, "Wait, are you still alive when you are in the air?" Principle four, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, or put more simply, we search for what is true. How interesting that as a teacher myself, this was the principle that initially kind of stumped me and that an example didn't readily come to my mind. What is truth? Some people will demand, "Tell me the truth." I thought about the 1992 movie that I saw on the TV briefly last night, A Few Good Men, when Jack Nicholson's character is being questioned on the witness stand by Tom Cruise, and then he proceeds to snap and say, "You want the truth? You can't handle the truth." What I do know is that in our UU church, you probably never hear a line like that. And I guess that is a comforting thought. Principle five, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large, or put more simply, all people need a voice. With ongoing efforts to stifle voter registration and participation of certain groups in our society, particularly those who are marginalized and most vulnerable, isn't this an issue we must be vigilant about upholding? Principle 6. The goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, or more simply, build a fair and peaceful world. With violence and injustice widespread, isn't it important that we focus our attention on all those who seek liberty and to live in peace, both within our borders and outside? Principle 7. Finally, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, or more simply, we care for our earth. Isn't it important to allow ourselves to be humbled and in awe of the majesty of the world around us? We are part of something greater and in relationship with the natural world. And of course, our choices that we make impact not only ourselves, but so many others. So in closing, it may seem like I have an infatuation with Jack Nicholson, but I'll refer to a more obscure Jack Nicholson movie, the 1997 As Good As It Gets film. After Jack Nicholson's quirky character, Melvin Udall, insults Carol Connolly, played by Helen Hunt, he realizes that he must apologize to her and let her know that he actually really appreciates her. He says he's going to give it a try, apologizing, that is, to which Helen Hunt replies, "I'm so afraid you are about to say something awful." Jack Nicholson says, "I've got an ailment. My doctor says that in 50 or 60% of the cases, a pill really helps. I hate pills. Very dangerous thing, pills. Hate. I'm using the word hate about pills. I hate them. My compliment is, spending time with you, I've started taking the pills." To which Helen Hunt replies, "I don't quite get how that's a compliment for me." And then Jack replies, "You make me want to be a better man." So that's why I give. Why I choose to financially support our church. Star King Unitarian Universalist Church, what you believe in and what you stand for, you, yes, you, make me want to be a better person.
Thank you so much, David. I have a confession to make. Stuart said earlier it's never the same service, and this isn't either, but I've came across a little order of service in my files that told me, after I had chosen this topic, that I had spoken of this topic in this sanctuary, actually when it was unfinished and turned around, 6 years ago. I came at the invitation of your minister to be one of the summer speakers. And my memory is fuzzy, but I seem to remember that she specifically asked because she heard I was doing an adult education class on the American Transcendentalists at the time in Fremont, where I was serving as interim minister. So she asked me to come and speak about Transcendentalism, and I did. And what's even more remarkable is that Stuart was the worship associate that Sunday. Clearly, he's been doing this a long time. Now, this is a different sermon, but some of the material is similar. Some of the information about the Transcendentalists is similar. So if it sounds familiar, but then again, 6 years is a long time. Who remembers these details, right? Especially as we age. But I also do it now as a prelude to an adult education class that I expect to offer here in May, a 5-week class, and I have a sign-up sheet in the social hall on the back table for you to indicate your interest and also your preference for when the class should be held. I'm not sure yet, and there are several possibilities listed on that sheet. So if you're interested in the Transcendentalists and in learning more and reading their own works, please sign up on that sheet. I like the silent church before the service begins. This quote was inscribed on the back of a pew in the church I attended many, many years ago in New York City, community church in the city, downtown on Park Avenue. I often heeded the gentle reminder to sit and enjoy the silence, the silent church before the service begins. What I did not know at the time was the rest of the quote, which was, I'm sure, deliberately left out. The entire sentence is, I like the silent church before the service begins better than any preaching. Although Emerson himself began as a preacher, as a Unitarian minister in a long line of ministers, he gave up his pulpit after only 2 years to pursue the career that he became famous for, as a writer, lecturer, essayist, and as a prime shaper of a uniquely American culture. Some 3 decades ago, on a visit to Harvard University, I stood in the very room in which Ralph Waldo Emerson gave his most well-known lecture, the Divinity School Address, given to the graduating class of new ministers in 1838. I had a profound sense of awe as I stood there in that surprisingly small and ordinary-looking classroom. The Divinity School Address is famous in part because Emerson was widely condemned for what he said in it, both by the Orthodox and by the establishment Unitarians. They were especially upset because Emerson called into question the notion that Jesus performed supernatural miracles, changing water to wine, curing blindness, causing the dead to rise up, multiplying loaves and fishes, and so on. The highly rationalistic older Unitarians of the day were shocked. It may seem non sequitur there, the rationalistic Unitarians were shocked. But they were rationalistic, and they were shocked, and one of them, Professor Andrews Norton, wrote a rebuttal to this address titled, On the Latest Form of Infidelity. You see, the old guard Unitarians, like Norton, still believed in the authority of Scripture. They just interpreted Scripture differently from the Orthodox Trinitarians, believing that Scripture supports the idea that God is one, not a Trinity, and that Jesus was a human prophet. But Emerson dared to suggest that the Bible was in error, that the real miracle is in the human heart and soul and in the world of nature. In, as he put it so brilliantly, the blowing clover and the falling rain, and not in the magical feats reported in Scripture. The older Unitarians, rationalistic as they were, believed in the miracles because they believed that there were witnesses to them and that the accounts were written down. Biblical scholarship was not what it is now. In that famous address, Emerson also alluded to the new lively philosophical movement that he and others were a part of, known as transcendentalism. This, too, did not sit well with the proper rationalistic Unitarians of the time, because transcendentalism dealt with other, less orderly aspects of human experience, the emotional, the ecstatic, the intuitive. Today, I would like to explore the transcendentalist movement a bit with you, and I would also like to discuss the experience of transcendence that the transcendentalists spoke about and recorded in their prolific journals. The transcendentalist movement, with its emphasis on self-reliance, on the primacy of the individual over institutions, helped to shape the individualistic American character. Ralph Waldo Emerson and John Wayne make strange bedfellows, but in fact, there is a relationship there, that rugged individualism. It was Emerson who asserted, "Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist." And Thoreau who said, again using the male pronoun, but that's what they did then, who said, "If a man does not keep peace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer." Emerson, Thoreau, and other transcendentalists urged Americans and American writers to break out of the mold of following European culture, to break out and create a distinctly American voice, or rather, a chorus of uniquely individual voices that would benefit a nation of individualists. I personally credit the transcendentalists with bringing me to Unitarian Universalism. Back in 1965, in a freshman English literature class, we were studying the American transcendentalists, and I was enchanted by their writings and their ideas. Well, a student in the class, not myself, happened to ask the professor whether the transcendentalists were part of any organized religion. The professor said most of them were Unitarians. I know that's the first time I ever heard that word. I came out of a Catholic background and was really not much of anything at the time this happened. Serendipitously, after that word Unitarian got planted in my brain, I saw a sign on the campus that said, "Unitarian Society meets here next Monday," or whatever day, and I decided to go check it out, and my life was forever changed. American Transcendentalism was a brief movement of the 1830s and 1840s, centered mostly around Boston and Cambridge and Concord, Massachusetts. So it was very confined, both in time and in space, and yet its influence has been far-ranging and long-lasting. The most well-known figures are Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau. Some of the other lesser-known transcendentalist lights were Margaret Fuller, Theodore Parker, Orestes Brownson, William Henry Channing, Elizabeth Peabody, and Bronson Alcott. They were quite a collection of characters. Included on the periphery were some well-known writers such as Herman Melville, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Walt Whitman. The transcendentalists formed little discussion salons and a philosophical club, and for a while they published a journal, The Dial. They wrote for many journals. Some of them lectured widely, some taught, and some of them were social justice advocates, working against slavery and for women's equality, setting up schools for children, advocating for labor reform. Some of them even participated in experiments in communal living. And of course, Thoreau experimented with living deliberately, as he called it, living simply and as self-sufficiently as possible on the shore of Walden Pond in Concord for 2 years. Many of the transcendentalists were raised Unitarians. They were the sons and daughters of the Boston Brahmins, the Unitarians who formed an elite Boston society. Some of the leading transcendentalists were Unitarian ministers, like Emerson, Theodore Parker, Frederick Henry Hedge, and William Henry Channing, who was the nephew of William Ellery Channing, who is often called the founder of American Unitarianism. The young transcendentalists found the Boston Unitarianism that they were reared in to be cold and overly rationalistic. They called its intellectual center, Harvard Divinity School, an ice house. And Emerson called Boston Unitarianism corpse cold. The younger generation of Unitarians took the religious freedom that their parents and forebears fought so hard for and ran further with it than the older generation was comfortable with. They sought a more emotionally fulfilling, less formal and Bible-oriented religion. Emerson, who was weary of what to him was the empty ritual of serving communion, resigned his ministry after 2 years because he did not want to perform the weekly communion rite. Some scholars have suggested that he was also not really all that well suited to the ministry with all of its pastoral demands, not as suited to that as to what became his career, his solitary career as a writer. Those who remained ministers, and several did, made significant reforms in their churches. They did away with the practice of pew rentals, where people would actually rent a pew and no one else could sit there. They eliminated the distinction between minister and congregation in many ways. They often held conversations instead of giving formal sermons. And William Henry Channing even got rid of the traditional high-up New England pulpit. If you've been there, you've seen these pulpits that almost have clouds below them. They're so high. He got rid of that. He came down into the pews for his conversations. The root word of that six-syllable mouthful, transcendentalism, is transcendence, clearly. And the transcendentalists believed in an inherent morality in the human soul and in a reality behind the ordinary world. Emerson called it the oversoul. This reality, they said, occasionally breaks into our awareness and we experience transcendence. They believe that we can each experience firsthand this reality, which is deeper, wider, and more essential than our ordinary day-to-day lives. Through this awareness, we can feel, not just understand intellectually, but feel and know that we are one with all that is. The experience of transcendence for the transcendentalists took precedence over formal creeds, religious rituals, traditions, scriptures, and ecclesiastical authority. As Emerson put it in the Divinity School address, it is an intuition. It cannot be received at second hand. Because of this focus on self-reliance and against tradition and received authority, the transcendentalists came under heavy criticism, even from the Unitarians of their day, as I've mentioned, although eventually their ideas quietly seeped into mainstream Unitarianism. Transcendentalists also brought to Unitarianism and to American culture the ideas of Eastern religious traditions, like Buddhism and Hinduism, which emphasized cultivating this firsthand religious experience. Thoreau, in fact, took a copy of the Hindu Bhagavad Gita with him to Walden Pond, and he found much inspiration from this and other sacred Hindu texts. The focus on personal religious experience over tradition and scripture was called heresy and infidelity in the transcendentalist day, but it is accepted today among Unitarian Universalists. In fact, and David went over the principles, it is named, well, he didn't go to the sources, that's the second part of the statement. It is named as the first source of inspiration. There are seven sources of inspiration in our Unitarian Universalist statement of principles and sources in our bylaws as a denomination. As that statement says, we draw inspiration from direct experience of the mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces that create and uphold life. Direct experience is the key there. The experience of transcendence, as the word implies, lifts us beyond our small selves. Transcendence connects us to something larger than our individual personal concerns. It renews us. It restores balance and a sense of awe and wonder in our lives. It is the best antidote that I know of to the cynicism and the emotional and spiritual fatigue we are prone to in our modern world. You may remember in the 1950s, psychologist Abraham Maslow wrote a book on the transcendent experience. It was titled Religions, Values, and Peak Experiences. Maslow preferred to call it a peak experience, which he felt was a way to make it more accessible to a modern understanding. Maslow actually said that some people are peakers and others are not. Although I would agree with much of what Maslow says about peak experiences, to the notion that some are peakers and some are non-peakers, I would say hogwash. We are all peakers, or at least potential peakers. Most of us have had transcendent, religious, peak, whatever you want to call them, experiences, though we may not necessarily recognize them as such. In the Building Your Own Theology class that I frequently teach, there is often a mix of atheists, theists, agnostics, pagans, humanists, liberal Christians and Jews, Buddhists and others. This is our Unitarian Universalist constituency. And I have found that all of us can find within our lives such transcendent moments, however fleeting they might be. Such experiences often have many of the following characteristics described by Maslow and others. They have an ineffable quality. The experience is very hard to put in words. They have a feeling of timelessness, a sense of a loss of ego boundaries, a sense of a deep connection to one's surroundings. The experience may be fleeting, but the memory of it lasts. And it often also has what some have called a noetic quality. That is, having had the experience, you have a sense that you have seen a glimpse of the truth of what reality really is. I would like now to try to describe one such experience of mine. Back in 1970, when I was in graduate school at Hunter College in the Bronx, I maintained an apartment with several friends. The apartment was in a dingy gray brick building, wedged in between other brick buildings and flanked on one side by the elevated subway. This is not your most pastoral of settings. Although we did have a rooster in the neighborhood. The darn thing crowed every morning, and it lived in the alleyway behind our apartment. So late one evening, in this less than romantic setting, I was sitting in the kitchen, sipping coffee, idly stringing small beads onto a necklace, and conversing with a close friend, my friend Mitch, who was back visiting New York from his first year at Star King Seminary in Berkeley, the school I was about to enter that fall. He and I were discussing rather intently some theological questions. We had been carrying on this intellectual exploration for some hours. It was getting quite late. After a while, Mitch rose and walked into another room, and I just resumed stringing the beads quietly. But suddenly, I noticed that the beads seemed to be shining, that they looked more colorful than before. I blinked and I looked up and moved my eyes around the room. The entire kitchen scene, which I thought I knew so well, looked aglow with a vividness and intensity that I had never noticed. As I looked at the ordinary objects in the kitchen that I normally took for granted, seeing them in an indescribably new way, my eyes came to rest on Mitch, who had suddenly appeared back in the doorway. Mitch especially looked aglow. He looked radiant, and here's where words fail and poetry and metaphor have to take over. He looked radiant with a kind of inner light or energy that I then realized is always part of the being that Mitch is. I felt a oneness with Mitch and with everything around me. There really was no me in the usual sense. I was acutely aware of being one with my surroundings, one with the universe. This was not an intellectual conclusion. This was a felt experience. It's as if an unseen presence, for want of better words, an energy or radiance which is locked up in everything and is usually blocked from our perceptions, was revealing itself to me. I had the distinct sense that this truth, this reality, is always there. But with all of our details and dates and deadlines in our day-to-day lives, we miss it. And indeed, the great religions of the world proclaim that the truth is around us, but we usually overlook it. To seek it, said a Zen Buddhist master, is like looking for an ox when you are riding on one. Or as Jesus put it in the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas, the kingdom of heaven is spread out on the earth, and people do not see it. Moments of transcendence like this seem to just come to us unbidden, but I believe we can create an increased potential for them to occur. By clearing the decks in our lives, taking time to just be, instead of always rushing around and accomplishing things, we may invite a transcendent moment, a deepened awareness. The Vietnamese Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh says you also need to empty yourself of even the expectation that something will happen, since that can get in the way of being fully present in the moment, the eternal now. This is particularly hard for us impatient modern Westerners to do, letting go of our expectations. Although the experience I described occurred in an urban setting, many find the natural world to be a particularly fitting location in which to experience the sense of awe and transcendence that I'm describing. You can go into nature, you can go up a hill, a mountain, you can go by a lake or by the ocean, or to a simple garden, a park, a little grove, or you can even seek a quiet corner somewhere indoors. Once there, all you need to do is just be. Take in the sights, the sounds, and the scents. Be open and receptive. Breathe deeply. Zen Buddhist leaders and teachers also say that you can adopt this open and receptive frame of mind while lying down, while walking, while washing the dishes, even while running, although it takes practice. The poet Wallace Stevens, in a poem, wrote simply of the transcendent experience. He wrote, "Perhaps the truth depends upon a walk around the lake." Speaking of a walk around the lake, and to return briefly to the transcendentalists before I close, a few summers ago, I had the chance to walk around Walden Pond in Concord, the lake made famous by Henry David Thoreau, who went to live simply and intentionally on its shores for 2 years, and who wrote about it in his most famous book. It was another time in my life filled with a sense of awe and reverence as I visited the site of Thoreau's cabin, went to pay my respects at the grave sites of Emerson and Thoreau, and went to the old house, now a museum, where Emerson and his family lived, not far from Walden Pond. I stood at each of these sacred sites and contemplated the contributions of the transcendentalists, that little group of thinkers and writers who, in a few short years, made a big contribution to American literature, philosophy, and culture, and to the religious movement that we call our own. I close with a quote from Henry David Thoreau, who in this journal entry spoke of the aftermath of the transcendent experience. Our ecstatic states, which appear to yield so little fruit, have this value at least. Though in seasons when our genius reigns, we may be powerless for expression, yet in calmer seasons when our talent is active, the memory of those rarer moods comes to color our picture and is the permanent paint pot, as it were, into which we dip our brush. He continues, our moments of inspiration are not lost, though we have no particular poem to show for them. For those experiences have left an indelible impression, and we are ever and anon reminded of them. Their truth subsides, and on cooler moments we can use them as paint to gild and adorn our prose. And that is what the transcendentalists did. If you want to read more about them, join our class.